Peter B. Collins, news and comment. We survived the most disgusting political debate in American history. It is Monday, October 10th, 2016. This free daily news and comment podcast is now available on YouTube. Be sure to spread the word about that, will you? Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, was the scene of the second presidential smackdown debate. And with two of the most unpopular candidates in American history running for the major parties, what we saw was a kind of spitball exchange as each tried to drive up the negatives of the other. And who won or who lost is really a matter of your perspective. I would say that Hillary Clinton withstood a withering series of assaults, and she maintained her composure, and she did attempt to talk about policy from time to time. And Trump, who wasn't quite as unhinged in some respects as he was in the first debate, was more unhinged when it came to deflecting attention to the sexual comments, the very vulgar remarks that were released on Friday. A videotaped interview 10 years old done by Billy Bush, who's now been suspended from NBC. And why did it take this tape for NBC to see what an idiot Billy Bush is? At any rate, it was a fairly bizarre proceeding. And I fault the moderators and the format. It was a terrible arrangement. The questions that came from members of the public who were, we were told, are undecided were terrible. I mean, it was just the weakest lineup of questions I've ever seen in a presidential debate. And while Anderson Cooper and Martha Raddatz had the latitude to follow up, they mostly were trying to keep Trump from talking on and on and on, and Hillary did go overtime several occasions as well. And there was a little bit of argumentation back and forth that we might get into here. But the evening was framed by the media's approach. They were broadcasting live from the gutter and waiting for the candidates to get right down there, and not only into the gutter, but into the sewer. And the speculation that I saw in the pregame, and it is kind of like a sporting, the coverage, the whole way it's arranged, the way it's promoted, is similar to, you know, the finals in baseball or football. And this, of course, further takes us down in a spiral where we don't talk about the significant issues. It's just the neener-neener and who got off the best zinger, which one will go viral. Because even though I would imagine 80 to 100 people watched the debate, I haven't seen any numbers so far. The real impact is in the clips that get replayed for several days after the event itself is over. And depending on, you know, what you prefer, you can sit there and say, oh, yeah, you know, Hillary really knocked it out of the park. And in some cases, I gave her high marks for, again, maintaining her composure and dealing with the multitude of lies that spew forth from Donald Trump. One of the best lines I've seen is, you may have heard there are some Republicans who are desperate to dump Trump. It's too late for that. And I saw this line on Facebook. It's time for Republicans to experience what it's like being forced to carry to term. I think you know what I mean. And so the framing of this was, in some ways, set just minutes before the debate, when Trump surprised everyone by doing a live Facebook news conference where he trotted out four of the alleged victims of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Now, we know that Kathleen Willey was groped by Bill Clinton in the Oval Office as he was consoling her on the death of her husband. Anita Roddick claims that Bill Clinton raped her. Paula Jones got an $850,000 settlement from Bill Clinton. And the fourth woman, who was new to me, and I don't have her name right in front of me, she apparently was a rape victim and Hillary Clinton represented her rapist, or the accused rapist, in her case. And I, again, have no details on that particular story. It kind of came out of nowhere. But, you know, as we looked at this, everybody knew that Trump was going to have a rehearsed response to the Pussygate tape. And yes, it is a remarkable development when Saturday's New York Times, on the front page above the fold, used the word pussy and bitch in quotes from Donald Trump, without, you know, using stars or other characters to obscure the actual term that was being published. And it shows, I think, how determined the Times is to eradicate the Trump scourge. But that's also editorializing in the news columns. And I look at that askance, is the best way I can say it. So Trump kept saying that he's embarrassed, that he's apologized to Melania, and that this was locker room talk. He used that phrase 6 or 7 times. Locker room talk, locker room talk. And, of course, a lot of guys can say, well, you know, I've said crude and vulgar things like that when I knew that only guys were around. And I think, again, for Trump supporters, this is another rationalization that will generally work. And the ability for Trump supporters to rationalize appears to be unlimited. So in the early outing, the first question was a softball from a listener concerned, or I mean from a citizen who's concerned about kids watching the debate and whether the candidates are role models for our children. And Hillary had a very carefully rehearsed answer that didn't address the Pussygate tape itself. And then Trump came back and said, it's just words, and had a bunch of blah, blah, blah. And then it was Anderson Cooper who opened the lid to the sewer by asking about that tape and what he had to say about it. And, of course, he gave us the locker room recitation, and he immediately pivoted into saying that he wants to cut the nuts off the Islamic State. That's my characterization, not his. And it was bizarre, because we were just getting cozy in the locker room and kind of, you know, getting a whiff of the Bengay and the Lysol, when suddenly he's talking about ISIS chopping off people's heads. And I got whiplash from that. It was a total non sequitur. But Trump's mind works, or, you know, doesn't work in that way. Then in the second round, responding to a question from Jeff from Ohio, who asked if the campaign had changed you, Trump then went and unloaded on Bill Clinton. Said that my locker room talk was just words. Anderson Cooper said, did you ever grab a woman by her genitals? And he claimed no. When we get to the fact check section here in a moment, we'll review that again. But he unloaded on Bill Clinton, saying that it wasn't just words for Clinton, it was actions. He was abusive. He attacked women. And then Hillary Clinton helped destroy those women who were victims of Bill Clinton. And he repeated several times that Hillary should be ashamed and she's the one who should be apologizing. So he's trying to turn the tables on her. Hillary's response to that, which is consistent because for more than 20 years, she has never publicly commented on Bill's Bill's problems. And she said, she quoted Michelle Obama saying, when they take the low road, we take the high road. And that was her way of just ignoring the entire issue. And I would say that that is not a very effective response. Now, I know that Clinton supporters say, you know, nobody has any business going there. It's between Bill and Hillary. Well, it's not. Bill Clinton lied knowingly under oath before the grand jury, or in that deposition, it was a deposition. And she, through her silence and through the actions she's taken behind the scenes, has worked to undermine, if not destroy, the women who are seen by Bill Clinton as bimbos. And I point this out because I don't get any pleasure out of demeaning Bill Clinton. But the corporate media just glosses over all this stuff and ignores it, and it has great traction and kind of catnip or even kryptonite value in the right-wing media machinery. And many Clinton supporters don't have a clue about that. The other thing that was interesting is several times Trump quoted Bernie Sanders or used Bernie Sanders' arguments against Hillary Clinton. I'm not quite sure how he thinks that is terribly helpful, but in many ways he used it as a wedge to drive at Hillary. And some of his most remarkable statements were at one point she was talking about how terrible it would be if Trump was in charge of our law enforcement system, and he just said, yeah, you'd be in jail. And at another point, he said that, Hillary Clinton has a tremendous amount of hate in her heart. And I'm a sharp critic of Hillary Clinton. I will not be voting for her. But even for me, I found that breathtaking. I disagree with Hillary on many things, but I don't think she hates in her heart. I don't think she has a tremendous amount of hate in her heart. I think she's a career politician with outsized ambition. But I don't equate that with hate. Another interesting pivot was when Trump was asked about the Muslim ban that he proposed last year, and that Mike Pence in the VP debate kind of said, well, that's not really the policy anymore. And Trump didn't answer the question. He pivoted to talking about the San Bernardino accused shooters, and that all kinds of people knew they were making bombs in their garage and didn't report it. And so it was really weird, because instead of talking about the issues that he's raised before about immigrants from the Syrian war zone and Muslims in particular, he went on a tangent that really didn't make any sense, and he fed the fact checkers another fat lie. When asked about his demonization of Mr. Khan, the guy who spoke at the Democratic National Convention about his son, the war hero, well, Trump acknowledged that Captain Khan was a hero, and then he offered the most impossible hypothetical. He said he would be alive today if I had been president back in 2003. Huh? I mean, okay, you can say that, but it doesn't really mean anything. Hillary Clinton routinely blamed Russia for the problems in Syria as if they had been there from the very beginning. She blamed Russia for the hacks and the uncomfortable emails that we're going to get to in just a moment that were released on Friday, overshadowed by the Trump sex comments. Another thing that Trump does is he blames Hillary for everything that's ever happened in Washington, saying that she's been there for 30 years, even though she only spent 8 years in the Senate, and that didn't start until the year 2000. But to try to deflect attention from the fact that he hasn't paid taxes in years, which he implicitly acknowledged, he said, well, it's her fault. She should have fixed the tax code. I don't get where that comes from. So, it was a very unsatisfying debate. At one point, the debate did drift into an actual discussion of foreign policy, the war policy in Syria. And I give Trump some credit, as I'll detail in a moment. But Hillary Clinton really, I think, is very weak in responding to these issues. She continues to call for a no-fly zone without noting that that takes 70,000 boots on the ground, and then said that we're not going to put boots on the ground in Syria when we already have at least a limited number of those boots on the ground. So I found her very contradictory, and she tried to be reassuring that she knows so much about Syria and that the Islamic State may be wrapped up or mopped up from Iraq by the time she takes office. And one of the curious comments that Trump interjected when he was asked about the Supreme Court situation and the death of Antonin Scalia, he shifted into an unrelated comment about how much money the Clintons have made since they left the White House. He used the figure $250 million. I think that's a little high. But he noted that he's going to be spending about $100 million of his money, maybe, on the presidential race, and that since she has made so much money, and she talks about the dark money that is enabled by Citizens United, why doesn't she put some of her own money in the campaign to reduce the amount of dark money in the campaign? That's pretty interesting little gambit that he offered there. But as I look at this, we saw at the opening once again Donnie Downer, who casts a pall over all the proceedings with his dark interpretation of where America is today and why only he can make it great. He acted like a sarcastic, entitled teenager, really bratty at times with his one-line zingers. And I want to note that there were a number of places where, despite the way he talks incoherently, that he lapsed into a certain level of lucidity. He talked about a special prosecutor for the Hillary Clinton email scandal. And while he put it in the frame of a vendetta, which I would never support, I think that objectively, a special prosecutor wouldn't be a bad idea. He correctly identified Obamacare as a disaster, although his idea of replacing it with free market principles is certainly no better. And he backed Hillary into a corner where he basically, you know, said that she's not willing to admit what a failure it is. And she, of course, says she wants to fix it and build on it. And that probably appeals to most Democrats, but not to most Republicans. Once again, talking about Syria, he kept saying that Hillary doesn't know who they are, the rebels on the ground in Syria. And then he surprised us all by disagreeing with Mike Pence. And in that moment, I agreed with Trump. What he disagreed with is that Pence said last week that we should be planning to put troops into Syria right away. And Trump is saying, no, he doesn't agree with that. He didn't say what his policy is. He continues to say that secret plans are the best. And then again, he had, I think, a worthwhile comment that we're seeing a lot of media coverage about the impending assault to retake Mosul from the Islamic State in Iraq. And I have asked the same question. Why are they telegraphing this? And why is it taking so long to launch this initiative? So I think there he, for a moment, made sense. He also pointed out, as I'm going to tell you in a moment, that nobody knows if Russia is responsible for the hacking of the DNC and most recently John Podesta's emails. Podesta's the campaign co-chair for Clinton. And he is accurate in that respect. So I thought that while Trump performed better, and there was, you know, some substance, as I had to strain to find those six or eight items, it still just leaves us hanging. And I don't think it persuaded many, if any, undecided voters. Now, to the fact-checking part, and even the fact-checkers don't agree on what the facts are. For example, Hillary Clinton said that she'd helped 8 million children obtain health coverage, and the New York Times says, yes, that's correct. She can back it up. The San Francisco Chronicle fact-checked that and called it a half-truth, saying that she was not actually directly involved in the so-called S-CHIP program. But most of the fact-checking weighs in against Trump, that he was extremely misleading about Christopher Stevens asking for more security in Libya, that he was mostly misleading when he said Syria, Russia, and Iran are fighting the Islamic State, that when he said that we have hundreds of thousands of people pouring into the United States from Syria and we don't know who they are, that is way off. He also heavily exaggerated the number of Syrian refugees that Hillary Clinton has said she is willing to accept into our country. Hillary got it wrong when she said since the Great Recession, the gains have all gone to the top. That was true until a month ago. So she needs to update her talking points. Also, Trump said that Hillary wants to go to a single-payer plan, and I wish that were true, but it is not. So that's just a sampling of some of the fact-checking that's going on, but most of that doesn't matter because people's impressions are based on their biases and what they see that either appeals to them or repulses them. So we learn now that behind the scenes, in order to stage that Facebook news conference, Donald Trump got into a nasty confrontation with the co-chair of the Presidential Debate Commission. His name is Frank Fahrenkopf Jr. He is a Republican, a former national chair of the Republican Committee, and he refused to allow Trump to use his VIP box seats to seat Bill's bimbos, if you want to call it that, or Bill's victims. And so Trump did back down on that. But it certainly, he was just so nasty when he appeared on stage. This background offers a little bit of an explanation to that. So there is now speculation that he may try to back out of the third debate because he has claimed that the moderators were unfair, they gave more time to Hillary, and because of this incident with the chair of the commission. So we'll see if that is going to actually take place. But I think that it's interesting to see that Trump is so arrogant and so unwilling to play by any rules that he just feels that he can come in there and, hey, grab Mr. Farenkopf by the balls. Because after all, he's Donald Trump. He can do whatever he wants. He's a celebrity. There's also a lot of fallout on the Republican side. Over the weekend, John McCain painfully pulled his endorsement of Donald Trump. And as I look at that, I have no sympathy for the senator from Arizona. Because if you just go back 8 years, it was his choice of Sarah Palin that has enabled this entire race to the bottom with Donald Trump. You can say anything. You can make it up. You don't have to do any homework. You don't have to know what you're talking about. Sarah Palin set that low standard. And Donald Trump has claimed it and taken it to a new low. And so I think that these Republicans, like I say, they're going to have to carry this one to term. There is no way out. And it's also interesting to see some of the commentary that has surfaced. And it's the reason I wrote the headline for this podcast, that this was a debate that only Jerry Springer could be proud of. I almost expected him to emerge from behind the curtain and say that he's going to replace Anderson Cooper and Martha Raddatz. But not this time. So all of this occurred after Friday's release of new leaked emails from WikiLeaks. And the same time, the White House was saying virtually, that Russia is responsible by providing providing no proof whatsoever of that claim. And this is a problem that I am glad to see. I'm not the only one who has commented on. We'll get to that in just a second here. But these are very damaging bits of information that have come out. And we don't actually have the full transcript of her speeches to Goldman Sachs. We have quotes that were gathered by the Clinton campaign and internally discussed before they decided, no, we're never going to release the actual transcripts of these speeches. And why? Well, it's because Hillary identified herself with the bankers. She sympathized with them over the meltdown of 2008 and said that any reforms should be written by the people who know the industry the best, the people in the room who just paid me six figures for this speech. And also, there's a chain of emails from the co-chair of the campaign, John Podesta, who also is the head of the Center for American Progress. And our friend Steve Horn wrote a piece at the Smog Blog that the Podesta campaign was very worried about. And they discussed whether or not to attack Steve Horn and his reporting. And they decided, no, it'll only give it more attention. But Steve, congratulations. You got inside the bubble there. So we're seeing this orchestrated response. This is what Podesta said. I'm not happy about being hacked by the Russians in their quest to throw the election to Donald Trump. That's bullshit. It really is. And it is an attempt to use this very clever, deceptive construct to claim that you can't believe any of these emails because they're all tainted by Russia. And that is pure crap. It really is. Glenn Greenwald has pointed it out in his recent commentary at The Intercept. And what he exposes is not only that there's no evidence that Russia is responsible for the hacks, but also that information that he is focusing on shows how the Clinton campaign cozied up to certain reporters and media outlets and had their way with them. They talk about Maggie Haberman, who used to work at Politico. She's now over at the New York Times. We have had her tee up stories for us before and have never been disappointed. Well, Haberman has written stories that may have disappointed the Clintons, but they were mildly critical and often achieved the media objectives. We also see lists of people like, Donna Brazile, who's now the chair of the Democratic National Committee. She is identified as a reliable surrogate for the Clinton campaign. There are also a list of anchors and reporters invited to a cocktail party in New York just in advance of Hillary's announcement in April of 2015 that she was formally entering the race. And our pal Rachel Maddow shows up on the list. I don't know if that cocktail party was the critical persuasion for our friend Rachel, but she's been in the tank with the Clintons all along. So some of these excerpts are very damaging. And get this, what I'm about to read you are three headlines that were written by the research director of the Clinton campaign. And these are examples of what they expected the media to write if the transcripts of the speeches were released. Clinton admits she is out of touch. Clinton says you need to have a private and a public position on policy. Clinton remarks are pro-Keystone and pro-trade. He should also add pro-fracking. So these are very damaging comments. They show that what Bernie Sanders was railing about over the past year was quite true. And it shows how two-faced Hillary Clinton truly is. There's also information regarding fracking. At the State Department, she promoted fracking, and Steve Horn has very carefully documented that in his reporting in the past. And she's quoted as saying, "Fracking was developed at the Department of Energy, and I've promoted fracking in other places around the world." And you may have noticed one of the final questions in the debate last night was about energy, and Hillary focused on energy independence and didn't oppose fracking at all. I also want to note that the New York Times wrote an analytical piece that was in the Sunday paper where they talk about how Obama might respond to the Russian hacking. But they don't question the assertion that the Russians are responsible. And I find this quite disturbing. And one more item here. I'm linking to Peter Van Buren's latest blog post. It's entitled, "A Government is Seizing Control of Our Election Process, and It Is Not the Russians." And I encourage you to read this because he describes how this is really an unproven set of claims and that they really they press credulity because the Russians really have no motivation to expose their ability to hack us if, in fact, they have done so. Today, I'm releasing an in-depth interview featuring Chuck Collins. He's a guy I've talked with several times over the last 10 years or so. His new book is called Born on Third Base, and he is a recovering member of the 1%. He renounced his inheritance of the Oscar Mayer meatpacking and hot dog fortune, and he has been working to tackle inequality for a long time. This is a set of issues that, of course, didn't get discussed in any meaningful way in the debate last night as the candidates traded spitballs. Here's a brief excerpt from my conversation with Chuck Collins.
Well, this is, I think, the battle of the story, you know, the battle of how wealth is created in our society. And I, you know, there are people who really adopt this "I did it alone" story. But if you kind of dig deeper into that or have a real conversation with them and say, really, were you kind of raised by wolves in the wild? You know, did you go to a high school? Were you in a community? Did you benefit at all from public investments? Did you get a scholarship anywhere? You know, you start to engage on, you actually didn't do it alone. And that's why I think it's important. And in the book Born on Third Base, I really try to tell stories, lift up examples of people who tell their story quite differently. And it's not to say individuals don't matter. You know, what people do matters and individual effort and creativity matters. But we exist in a society that is this fertile ground for wealth creation, thanks to the people who came before us and the public investments and the things that all of us contribute.
You can hear the full interview with Chuck Collins. I'm releasing it to my subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and all of our outlets. And every day I like to thank some of the people who make this podcast possible with your subscriptions. People like Bill Goodacre, John Anderson, and, John just dropped in recently, DGL, and Mona Kobus. Thanks to each and every one of you for your support. And if you're not a subscriber, come on over to peterbcollins.com and fix that right now. All you got to do is click on menu, then become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and you can take care of business real fast. I wanted to note that our friend Greg Palast will be screening his latest film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. We interviewed him in late August, and there's a special screening here in the San Francisco Bay Area at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco, and it'll be showing Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this coming weekend. And the filmmaker will be there along with others who participated in the film. And if you are able and local, I hope you will check that out. And finally today, I want to say something good about the New York Times. I often smack them around. I disagree with many of the things that I find in the paper of record. But in Sunday's paper, they spilled a lot of ink. I think it's over 10,000 words on a very important story. The headline reads, U.S. torture leaves a legacy of detainees with damaged minds. And it profiles a bunch of people, but they identify that more than half of the 39 people who the CIA admits went through torture, or so-called enhanced interrogation, now have shown psychiatric problems. And there are many others who might have the same fate, but they haven't been located or haven't been to a psychiatrist for any kind of evaluation. And the article is in part based on the honesty of a former military psychologist, a psychiatrist, General Stephen Xenakis. Xenakis really had his eyes opened when he was assigned to evaluate Omar Khadr, the Canadian who had been held as a teenager when he first got to Guantanamo. And Xenakis is very honest about the true impact of America's torture program on these individuals, so many of whom, who we now know, are innocent, completely innocent. If they're not completely innocent, they were bit players in terrorist schemes. And so I'm glad that the New York Times has taken the time and effort to publish a very important piece. And I'll also note that John Oliver, on his HBO show last week tonight, did a great piece about closing Guantanamo. I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. Well, I've about hit my 30-minute mark, maybe a little longer. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. I'll have more for you tomorrow right here. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until